Coaches with Steve Beck.
A very good Thursday. Race fans, Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM Online, and at our website, stevebeck.com. The week took a interesting turn. The pick six carryover at Keeneland. not a pick six that you think about. But yesterday you had some more fireworks. It's funny, no sooner did Nick and I talk about some formful results that you had a couple of prices that 14-1 to end the sequence, and there was one other, right? There was it the beginning and the end, the 7-1 to start, and then the 14-1 to end it, and that was enough. 226,000 today, and this is a $1 variety, like the New York pick six. No jackpot. It's a straight pick six, and so a serious carryover for the Thursday card. And I'm just I actually just had kind of a shifting opening that we might be able to get into it. I'm waiting to hear back from a couple people, and we might have a window here. All right. I mean, I've looked at about four of the races, and it's a good sequence. It's a really good sequence. Kind of fun. And you got plenty of turf. I didn't look at the weather. Is the weather okay? Is the weather okay in Kentucky? Let's take a peek. Although I gave up on one of those weather apps that I tried to use to replace Dark Sky. Yeah, there was. I tried. What was it? I'm not gonna disparage some unsuspecting weather service. Ah, sunny in 62 with a high of 84 today in Lexington. Not to worry. All right, so throw out those MTOs. We're not going to have to worry about them. The sequence starts in the fourth. $30,000 claimers on the main going long. Non-winners are two lifetime. Thought it was a little tricky, even with the 9-5 Kelsey Danner favorite. First level allowance, turf sprinting. I thought this was tough. Although we've certainly are we learning our lesson when those turf sprints look squirrely? Single Wesley Ward. he's actually got a 5-2 favorite in here. Daring Do with the five pound bug signed on, as it happens. Let's see. That's the. The 11? Yeah, the 11 horse. So, out wide with Walter Rodriguez, who's got 7 pounds to his credit, or make it 5, as my eyes fail me. Starter allowance, 6.5 on the main for boys. I thought, I think there was a horse that stood out here. There was, Chris Hartman. Devil's Tower, 7-5. Third level allowance going a mile and a 16th on the grass. This is a good group. There's actually quite a few horses in here that are coming off synthetic starts. That's a fun group. Second level allowance, mile and an eighth on the main, where Vittorio for Bill Mont and Irad Ortiz are the 6-5 favorite. Creative Minister turns up in here for McPeak. Jerry O'Dwyer's got a horse I thought that looked quite good. Cook Creek with Joel. Phil Sims has got War Campaign. That's a nice group. Eddie Keneally. And then the Nightcap maiden special going a mile on the turf for three-year-olds. And this is a tricky race, and there's some prices in here that look particularly fun. Brian Lynch has got a second timer, Forge and Fire, 15-1 with Julien Leperu. And then there's some of the obvious players, Just So for Chad and Balthazar for Neil Drysdale, Cyber Ninja for Mott. Those are the three morning line favorites on Nick's line. But I thought that Shug's got a returnee, Sherlock's Jewel. First Lasix and first start as a three-year-old. Mile on the grass. So a very, I think, pretty approachable but challenging sequence if you're in the mood on a Thursday to dive in and hit the pick six maybe. That would be it certainly would be timely ahead of Derby Oaks. Derby Oaks news continues to come forth. I actually, I gotta come back. We've got, I'm in the process of doing, of getting ready to go to Kentucky, leave, tomorrow. And I actually got a little bit of a window yesterday, or just this morning, because I was supposed to go to Vermont and get a haircut. And Jenna, who cuts my hair, she's a scratch. She's a vet scratch. So as a result, I will have the afternoon. I to get organized. But in the meantime, if you saw this desk, you'd be scared. It's a complete disaster. There it is. Oh boy, Isaac Murphy. because it's not a big book, but it was sort of hiding under a stack of PPs. Isaac Murphy, The Rise and Fall of a Black Jockey. Catherine Mooney today. Have a conversation, and Sean Clancy. We'll get Clancy in here. Sean, off to a terrific start with River D, but we'll catch up with Sean. Haven't talked to him in almost a month. I imagine he pestered me. I told him there's a big announcement today, and he pestered me for, what's the big announcement? And I told him we're going to the Iroquois, and so I'm sure he'll get a big kick out of that. Irish Thoroughbred Marketing conversation too this morning, and in fact, Charles O'Neill, who's the president of the Irish Thoroughbred Marketing, he's in Ocala, and we're going to touch base with Charlie this hour. All right, so look forward to that. Tony Black, and we've got two. Oh, boy. Two different incidents last Saturday, and Mig already gave you his take on IRAD and Arabian Lion and the way, he came down and confronted Luis Saez. Saez was unintimidated. So Tony's got some thoughts on that, and then we also, I told Tony to, I sent him the link, yesterday's unfortunate circumstance that cost Master of the Ring his life, and knock on wood, Tyler Gaffleone escaping injury, but yesterday at Keeneland, I didn't include that in the opening about the sequence, but the situation, Flavian Pratt struggling with his mount, Foreign Relations, struggling with his mount, who was lugging in terribly, and he could not maintain, you know, straight course, and in coming in, Master of the Ring clips heels and goes down hard, and couldn't be saved. So Tony's going to explain that, and you know, some, you know, there was some very, actually there was some very intelligent conversation about it, and Tony will give you what he thinks, you know, Ryder's reaction should be in that circumstance. I mean, it's easy for all of us in you know, retrospect, to watch it, you know, easily and you know, have a, you know, an opinion to formulate about, you know, how a Ryder should be handling that circumstance. It's a little bit more valuable to let somebody like Tony, who's been in that circumstance, say what is the best course of action. And listen, Flavien Prat is a fabulous rider. This was unfortunate, and he's at fault. I mean, there's really not a lot of ways around that. I mean, the degrees, I suppose. Thoughts first and foremost, Mike Ryan and who owned Master of the Ring, and just thankful that Mike Ryan, yeah, that's right. Right? Let me see. Yeah, Mike Ryan. That's what I thought. And Mike Makerbarn and Master of the Rings groom and everybody, 5-year-old, that deserved a better fate. One-time winner of Bodie Meister gelding, bred by Chippewa bloodstock. Tony Black on a couple of rider scenarios from, you know, ripped from today's headlines. Clancy Black, Charlie O'Neill, later. Got the nicest call yesterday after the show. Richard Kent called from Ocala, K's in sales, of course, and there's a function that he alerted me to, and Jackie Demerick is going to join us at the end of the show. And of course, Jackie busy at OBS as the Bree Show continues. The group, and I wrote it down, and of course now, like everything else, it's MIA. But it's for the farm workers in Ocala, an organization that assists the farm workers down there. Very cool. So there's a function on Sunday, and Jackie's going to tell you about it. All right, Jackie Demerick today. It's Thursday, so hour 3, Jeff Franklin, win using Thorograph. We picked out a race from Keeneland, the Elkhorn, actually. And I'll tell you straight out, that is not a race that I typically do well with. I struggle with those marathons, main track or turf, mile and a half. I just, you know, they're tricky reads, and I'm anxious for Jeff's input on the Elkhorn, because it's a good group, a familiar group too. So, you know, the idea of how do you, you know, where speed, you know, we're talking, you know, figures, performance figures, where speed is not necessarily, you know, at play as much. You know, it invariably, you know, marathon races are you know, they jog. 12 furlongs, they jog for about, you know, a mile, and then they dash home. So it's a little different, and I frequently struggle when it comes to that read. So we'll get Jeff's perspective, and there's the excellent stake at Oaklawn. In fact, I got the PPs here. Saturday, here we are sort of treading water, right, until, you know, the Sirius Derby activities begin. Well, if you didn't look yet at Saturday's cards, it is a really good Saturday of racing. You're going to be, your eyes are going to pop. You're going to be very surprised. There's good stakes at Oaklawn, including the Grade 2, the Oaklawn Handicap, right? Charge It comes back off that very disappointing performance in the Gulfstream Mile at 3-5. Proxy for Stidham and Godolphin. Stiletto Boy for Ed Mosier. And Last Samurai in here, who's bidding, I would think if Last Samurai wins this, he's the horse of the meet, right? Razorback Essex and Oaklawn Handicap, doesn't that earn you horse of the meet? So, nice group there, but that's not the race we picked. I picked that race that, it's interesting, the race that Steve Asmussen gave us as his lock this week, he basically said he'd be surprised if Red Route won, or Red Route won, got beat. And this is the Bathhouse Row. I should put up my good. I got a great picture of Bathhouse Row several years ago. I think this is a good race. And because Red Route won, added the blinkers last time, this time he gets first Lasix. Because it's not a point race, and it's not, you know, it's a spot where Lasix can be introduced to his changes. He already added the blinkers, and obviously he's keeping them on. And, you know, got beat 5 by Angel of Empire. And this race is a mile and an eighth. But Victory Formation shows up in here. That Two Eagles River out of the Arkansas Derby, who set the pace and then was overwhelmed. Tappet Shoes returns, sort of out of sight, out of mind. But yeah, comes back after that series of tries at Fairgrounds, and yeah, it's just the one win, but you'll remember that, you know, when Tappet Shoes won near the end of last year, he right away became kind of a, you know, one of those horses that, you know, started showing up on lists. And then there's some prices. Well, actually, Interlock Empire, McPeak, who tried the Arkansas Derby off the maiden win. So anyway, it's a 9-horse field. It's the Bathhouse Row. That'll be the other race that we go over with Jeff Franklin on the when using Thoroughgraph segment. So there we go. That's enough. Charlie O'Neill, Catherine Mooney, Tony Black, Sean Clancy, Jeff Franklin, Rich Eng. Got to get Rich Eng in for a pop. Although it's been quiet, obviously. There is some Vegas news, I guess. For baseball fans, the itinerant Oakland Athletics, previously the Kansas City Athletics, previously the Philadelphia Athletics. Boy, yeah, the A's prepared, I guess, to move again, right? Do you see this? To Vegas? Unbelievable. $1 billion baseball stadium with only 35,000 seats. it's a lot of investment per head, right? That's got to be the most expensive per head. That's got to be the most expensive stadium in history. It just occurred to me. Yeah. So they're excited. I'm sure they're excited. Vegas just sitting there, and all these sports teams keep popping up. So, all right, let me. I think it's 20. I do have other I do have some other... we'll feather it in. Actually, I'll save the Santa Anita stuff for Rich. They've got a nice start back Saturday card, which includes the Kona Gold. They're calling it the Hollywood meet, which is appropriate, right? The Californian on Saturday as well, and you got some familiar veteran types, and this acting as a lead-in toward the Hollywood Gold Cup. And, yeah, it's good. Yeah, the Santa Anita came up. Nice card. And, of course, we'll talk about it tomorrow with Rich. I sort of hinted at the Keeneland action as well. So we'll get to all that. And Indy, I suppose, they had a good second day. Another $2.5 million. And popped in on a just kind of eyeballed little bit what went on there. We'll slip that in too, so save pile all this stuff up. All right, let me I've got to pull up a Catherine's number here, so bear with me for a second. And we will bring her in to there we go. The Isaac Murphy story certainly, you know, I don't think it's a surprise overall. I mean, that, you know, I think anybody that takes any interest in the game's history, you know, becomes aware of Isaac Murphy pretty readily. But, you know, because of the period of time, his life and his career have been, you know, incomplete in terms of the story. And I'm anxious to hear Catherine's anxious to have Catherine Mooney join us. And I think we do. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning.
I just was sort of introducing, as I was reaching for you, I was kind of introducing, you know, Isaac Murphy, who I think anybody that starts to get interested in the game, you know, becomes aware of his, you know, of
different metrics to measure things at the sales, but sometimes you just have to rely on the old gut, and when you walk around, it feels good. So,
in terms of, here's somebody who can tell us. Look at him waving us off. So good. There's obviously two things that got to be brought in. That little bit of a financial, little bit of a, you know, international banking and
right.
And
through an idea,
you know, financial
and
we won't call
it. After a while, it occurred to me. I thought, this is a man who came up riding handicaps, and he learned at some point, like, if you win big, nobody's going to be that pleased with you if you're riding a mid-range handicapper, because it's just going to be a problem later. So he's, you know, basically his philosophy is, we're going to win by as much as we need to win by. We're not going to, you know, and I think that probably translated to, you know, horses who were happier, who had sounder and longer careers, And, you know, some of his great mounts, like Freeland, are famously just kind of being babied along because they're not that sound. And he's really contributing to their ability to perform at the highest level. And I think he can do that, first of all, because he just, you know, he's so good at getting a horse to do its best in this really quiet, understated way. Even horses who are really tough, like his first Kentucky Derby mount, his first Kentucky Derby winner, I should say, who he tries to get off of because he's like, this horse is crazy, and I don't want to do this. And then the owner said, well, you know, too bad, you gotta, or we're not going to release you. And he ended up, you know, bringing the horse home. But it's that he's really good at what he does, but it's also that I think, like, as you were just saying, there's this culture that's left over from before the war that, of course, black men are going to be in positions of authority and they're going to be in public-facing positions. And that's just, you know, how racing works. And one of the things that I found going through all those newspapers that you could really see that there was this like ongoing understanding that I don't think I had fully grasped, that racing is held up by black athletes in other sports as this metric by which their own sport should be judged. So Peter Jackson, who's a great black boxer, who's a friend of his, who has a terrible time trying to get a heavyweight title fight because no white man will fight him after he fights Jim Corbett for 61 rounds. Peter Jackson says, well, you know, okay, this is what's happening to me. Why don't Snapper Garrison and Jimmy McLaughlin refuse to ride against Murphy? And his point is, that's ridiculous. That would never happen in racing, right? That's not what racing's about. So why can't other sports be like this? And to me as a fan, I just found that so fascinating that there was this time in its history, because we're so used now to racing being held up as this, you know, very exclusive, very restrictive game that, you know, is constantly, you know, being attacked for being not inclusive. It was so interesting to see that in the 19th century, racing is sort of the model for all other sports in terms of, you know, hey, everybody competes here. And I just think that's such a fascinating history that, you know, especially as folks are trying to increase the fan base, is something that we could go back to and really, you know, market and be invested in.
The reference that we frequently, you know, associate because of the Derby's dominance, essentially in, you know, the game's presentation in mainstream America and worldwide, you know, the Derby exploits are the ones that are most, you know, quickly presented. He won three of the first Derbies, and the other successes and the great match race. You know, everybody basically thinks that. Seabiscuit and War Admiral was the only important match race in racing history. Salvatore and Tenney there have been so many match races that could be made into, you know, stories. Collections. But Salvatore versus Tenney, and I referenced Snapper Garrison. There were so many aspects of it. It almost feels like this was something. I mean, for other reasons, we don't have match races much anymore, or match races that are constructed as match races. Occasionally, you get two horses in a race, but not as a match race. I doubt there'll ever be a match race after.
Same way again.
It almost feels like if we still were doing match races, that they couldn't put Salvatore Tenney together in this era with Garrison and Isaac Murphy. I mean, it's almost too delicious a scenario.
Well, and I think it was also so it was so completely of a different time, in the sense that, you know, they've raced against each other on the New York tracks that summer. You know what I mean? And there's just been, it's a relatively recently minted rivalry, and there's this, like, you know, and we just don't race horses on that timetable anymore. I mean, you just couldn't do it, you know, and the fact that, you know, people are so primed for it over those 2 or 3 months, and then, you know, there it is. And that's the other thing about, you know, I, having looked at all those newspapers, and also I spent 2 months in the Keeneland Library, which, shameless plug for the Keeneland Library, it's the most, one of the most amazing repositories anywhere in America, I think. But I sat there and I looked at every page in every journal that they had, you know, relating to his career that I could find. And you get these amazing accounts, both there and in the New York papers, of what that race was like. And it's one of the times in American history that I wish I had been there. I mean, they had an alderman meeting. They had a New York City alderman's meeting that was scheduled for that day, and they couldn't hold it because all those guys had gone AWOL because they'd gone to the track to see the race. And I mean, the city stopped. I mean, New York stopped to see that race. And then when they finished it, the things people said about it, you know, that they'd said they'd seen this thing that they were going to tell their grandchildren about, that this was the highlight of their lives. I mean, and John Hervey lives to see Man of War. And when people say, who's the greatest horse you ever saw? He says, it's Salvatore. I mean, that must have been an amazing experience. And he's the one who brings the horse home. I mean, no wonder people are just beside themselves over it. God, I wish I'd been there. It must have been incredible. Well, and then, you know, I mean, in a way, it's like, it really is also for him just this extraordinary moment, because, you know, afterward, he's talking to the press, and then he goes back to sit with his wife in the box, and the editor of the biggest black paper in America is there, and T. Thomas Fortune. And Fortune is very open about the fact that he is not a racing fan. He's just like, I know it's a thing, but I don't really follow it. But he and his attorney, who are actually also in the midst of trying to desegregate New York hotels, so they're a little busy, like they're in court all the time that summer. They're like, no, we have to go to this. We want to see this because this is this amazing historical event. And they sit down and they're just making small talk. And then Fortune can't really help himself because he's a journalist. So he kind of starts to halfway interview Murphy. And he says to him, well, okay, you know, just sitting around, you know, just reading the newspaper, I've heard that you really kind of like to draw out a finish. I've heard that you like to kind of cut it close. Is that true that you do that on purpose? And he claims that Murphy looked at him and he smiled and he said, I ride to win. And that was it. That was the end of the conversation. And Fortune goes home and he writes an editorial in the biggest black newspaper in America. And he says, this is it. This is the way black Americans are going to achieve civil rights, that the excellence of men like this is going to be our model. And it's going to convince people that, you know, multiracial democracy is the future. I mean, so it's, for Murphy, it's just this extraordinary moment where the eyes of the whole country are upon him and people are just fascinated by him. And you lay that on top of the fact that it's, you know, one of the greatest horse races in American history. My gosh, just writing about it gave me goosebumps. I can't imagine what it must have been like to be there.
You know, it's also, there's probably people that don't even realize they've seen a very famous, there's a Currier and Ives that at virtually every racetrack management office you go to, or administration building that you go to, there is a oversized copy. Chances are, I mean, we're talking 1890.
Yeah.
So there's probably original. They're probably all original Currier and Ives of Salvatore and Tenney. And it's one of those images that it just is It, people probably don't know that that's what they're looking at, but that's who it is. With the elongated, as I always laugh, those elongated bodies and the right. The Curry and I, they always have the, you know, the horse's eyes are always like you know, rolling in their head,
6 inches
like
the, out from the head.
Exactly. It's very right. Always made, it's really fun, but it's, you know, it's so obvious even without. Even without the title, that it's, you know, that it's Snapper Garrison on Tenney and Isaac Murphy on Salvatore. It's actually 1890, really the kind of the pivotal, right? It's a pivotal point in his career, because literally what, months later, things start to go awry.
Oh yeah, oh, it's the apex. And in fact, when I was doing research for this book, you know, when you study Murphy, you'll see pictures of him from that summer, and people talk about how after the race they have the, you know, they have the huge party and he's there, and that's sort of part of the, you know, part of the legend. But Keeneland very kindly dug out for me images of that party that I'd never seen before, and they really are amazing. I mean, it's this row of white tablecloth tables in the middle of this, you know, pine glade in, you know, near Monmouth Park, and these guys have clearly shown up, you know, wearing three-piece suits, but to have this, you know, celebration, and he's sitting there at the head table, and you look at the picture, and it really is a reminder of the kind of celebration and the kind of luxury that success had sort of brought him into contact with. And he's sitting there, and he's, you know, he's clearly, you know, he's this is not totally new, but it is remarkable, is just looking at the picture, that he is very clearly the only black man present. And it's, I mean, and it's just visually arresting, where you're just like, oh, there are a lot of people here, and, you know, here he is. And it really makes you think about how it would have appeared at the time. And that party gets a lot of coverage, you know, people talk about it. And also, you know, doing the book made me really plot out what the timetable was, because I knew that it all happened that summer, and I knew, you know. But it really is, as you say, I mean, it's literally days. It's literally, you know, less than a month that he then goes to Monmouth Park. And at that point, you know, he's kind of, I think it's important to remember that by 1890, he's having even more trouble than he's ever had with weight, right? So, I mean, like, he's kind of got a specialty contract with Hagen at that point, where he's riding in the really important stakes races for older horses, because he just can't do the weight and the grind of the other stuff. So, I mean, basically he's riding Salvatore and Ferenczi, and then he's kind of doing, you know, case by case stuff for Hagen and for other people. So it's not necessarily like, oh yeah, you know, I was busy all summer, and, you know, this just came up. It's like, these are his marquee rides. And he gets on Ferenczi in the Monmouth Cup, and it's evidently really striking. I mean, he is really out of it. He is clearly in physical distress, and he's barely in control of the horse. He then comes off the horse. The assistant starter helps him get back on, you know, and the crowd, I mean, it was evidently scary to watch. I mean, people thought he was going to get hurt, or somebody else was going to get hurt. And then they, you know, they do the disciplinary hearing at Monmouth Park. And that's, we tell that story as, you know, this is the beginning of the end, kind of. And so I ended up doing a lot of, you know, going through all the accounts of what had happened. And because also there's been, of course, a long history of, you know, people talking about, well, what did happen? You know, maybe he was poisoned, maybe, you know, this, that. And as far as I can tell, it's just this sort of terrible confluence of things, right? Where he's been saying for at that point, at least 5 years, maybe longer, that he can't do the weight anymore, that he's going to become a trainer. He's been buying horses to kind of, you know, you can tell that he's like, look, talking to Ed Brown and John T. Clay and other guys in the community about, you know, how do you get started as a talent spotter, you know, kind of a, and he's working on that. And he's riding to kind of keep the cash flow going, right, I think. And, but physically, it is just devastating to his body. And I think probably what you're seeing at Monmouth Park that day is a man who had no business being in a saddle.
Yeah.
And he had been very open about that, you know, for years. Of the, I mean, and even more in 1890. I mean, when he rode Riley in the Derby in 1890, he later told the paper, he said, you know, I went to the barn, picked up the silks, and the grooms literally said, do you want to see the horse? I mean, do you physically just want to see the horse? He'd never been on him. And he said, no, I don't need to see him. You know, I mean, he said, I couldn't even look at him because I had to go lie down. And so it's kind of not surprising that something like this would have happened. It just happened at a really terrible time. And because there was so much attention on him and there was so much money and she was such a short price favorite. And then there's this whole debate about, well, you know, what happened and why did it happen? And it's not like the press knows, right? The press knows that jockey weights are a terrible health crisis, and they're very conscious of that. So, I mean, people have that context. But the other thing, of course, was that he later admitted that, you know, he hadn't eaten anything for, you know, maybe 48 hours. Hmm. And, I mean, yeah, no wonder you were in bad shape. And then he had, before he went to the track that day, he had had two milk punches. And I looked it up. And evidently, in the 1890, I mean, I don't think this was like common medical opinion, but this was definitely like a circulating idea that the combination of dairy and alcohol actually acted as a stimulant. And so it was sort of, I mean, that was sort of his way of like trying to get up to ride, I think. And, you know, then he gets to the track and he has bottled water. And, you know, he would later say that he thought he'd been poisoned. But I mean, the truth is, it seems very clear that you wouldn't have to be poisoned to have your body just revolt, right? It having nothing in it and then having dairy and alcohol in it. I mean, if he was drunk, it was basically because he had nothing in his stomach. And so, I mean, I think health-wise, you're looking at a crisis that was waiting to happen, and it happened. And it continues, you know, the repercussions of it continue to affect his career, and he has a hard time, you know, getting back fit to ride and then making weight. But I also think the thing that really strikes me that in some ways is, you know, more telling than this whole debate about, well, was he poisoned or not? Because I think we can basically say there is no evidence that he was. It was just, and there's a very logical chain of events, but that, you know, for 10 years before this, right, reporters have been noticing that occasionally, you know, this is a very restrained guy, it's very introverted, and there are occasions where he's kind of like loud, and they say, oh yeah, okay, we know why that is, right? He's had a little too much to drink. And it's not because he's a recreational drinker, it's because he, like a lot of other jockeys, is drinking and not eating because they think that's a stimulant that's going to allow them to ride. And so there's this sort of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Everybody knows what that is. This is just like the cost of the profession, you know, and nobody treats it as a handicap or a character flaw or anything like that. And, you know, and it's kind of like, well, if you don't know that happens to jockeys, then, you know, you're not really, you don't really know the game, you know. And then the really important thing to me is that after this happens at and that does appear to be how the people at the track handle it. You know, David Withers and you know, and the board at Monmouth Park are basically like, yeah, okay, we, you know, we get it. This is what happened. We don't think it's your fault, but we do think that there was a lot of money at stake and this looks bad. And so we're going to sit you down. I think he had a meeting, you know, a 2-meeting suspension, which I think was emotionally devastating for him because he just prided himself so much on not having ethics issues that he regarded as, you know, kind of devastating to other jockeys. But in the press, you suddenly see people who are like, well, he's a drunk. He can't have a job anymore. And to me, that's the most interesting thing where you're like, wait a minute, you guys were saying something real different not that long ago. Why did you turn on a dime like this? And I don't have a really good answer to that, but I would say that the same newspapers at the time are talking a lot about how successful he's been all summer. And they're also talking about other black athletes at the time. Peter Jackson had a very good summer that year. And, you know, kind of like, wow, this is getting a little, you know, and they talk about that. And also the weirdest thing is that there's some newspapers that when they're covering Murphy, you know, they're covering the disciplinary hearing, they'll suddenly shoehorn in stuff about what's going on in Congress. And part of what was going on in Congress at the time was this very controversial bill that was supposed to try to help with voter suppression for black voters in the South. And that was generating a lot of attention. But I mean, it has nothing to do with racing. And yet somehow on multiple occasions, when people are talking about this hearing, they'll be like, oh yeah, I bet Isaac Murphy doesn't care about the elections bill. And I'm reading it thinking, then why are you bringing it up? And it feels sort of like in this unconscious way, there were a lot of people in America who had sort of started to connect him with how they felt about politics, and particularly the politics of race in general, in a way that they had not before, and that made people uncomfortable. And I think that came together with what happened to him physically in a way that was devastating for his career. Sorry, I get so excited about talking about this that I just want to shut up.
No,
so
that's fine. We should include, as we round this out, Catherine Mooney joining us, Isaac Murphy, The Rise and Fall of a Black Jockey from Yale University Press. He himself was somewhat apolitical, right? He didn't have an active outspoken position in that regard.
Oh, I have no record that he ever took a political position in public. And that may be because he just, you know, wasn't that guy, or it may be because he just thought, you know, that wasn't good for him professionally or whatever. I mean, but there are black horsemen who are his friends who are more active politically. So, I mean, John T. Clay is his best friend. And John T. Clay actually sues to try to stop segregation in Kentucky. So, I mean, clearly what's going on, you know, when they're hanging out at the barns and when they're, you know, I'm sure, but having dinner at each other's houses, I think they are talking about politics, and they're horsemen who are very clearly involved in civil rights politics, particularly in Kentucky. But he is just studiously, right? That's not what he's there to do. And that was part of sort of trying to figure out the irony of his life was like, how does this man come to symbolize politics for so many people when he himself is, you know, so completely refusing to engage with that?
We don't want to tell everybody everything, right? we do want them to pick up the book, certainly, Catherine. And
great.
We should also note this is the second title in Yale University Press's Black Lives series, and the opportunity on this topic. I mean, that they came to you, and that, you know, as you explained earlier, that, you know, the opportunity to focus in on you know, one of the featured stars, really, of you know, your first book, which is, for those that haven't had a chance to see, Race Horse Men: How Slavery and Freedom Were Made at the Racetrack. This is value, but that book and this, there isn't enough of this brought to light, Catherine, in the game. And we had a long, I mean, the game has had a long association with black horsemen and both reinsmen and caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
And a portion of that has really faded from view. And a lot of that has to do, in fact, you talk about agrarian society, and we bring this up a lot about, one of the challenges that racing has in this era is that, America is really not an agrarian society much at all anymore. And not that seen, not that is really experienced. I mean, the proximity to horses is just a greater distance than ever before. And so, the excitement or interest, you have to seek it out. But at the same time, caretakers of horses, that's one of the reasons Central and South America, are
mm-hmm.
sources in this era of caretakers and riders and trainers too. Black American history and thoroughbred racing, not just thoroughbred harness too, are certainly had glorious periods and things that that people should know more about.
Yeah, and I'm hopeful that with Inside the Backstretch and other sort of efforts to document everybody who works around the horse, that we can celebrate, all the folks who are part of that and really start telling all those stories. Because to me, that's one of the most beautiful parts of the game.
Well put. What are you working on next?
Well, right now I'm thinking about turning my attention to women in the industry, because those stories keep coming up. Going through all those old turf magazines and thinking about the long history women have had in this industry and that they continue to have. And so it's kind of a parallel story, but it's been really interesting, and it's all kinds of stuff I did not know about. And, to me as a woman who grew up with horses, it's cool to see my own prehistory. So hopefully that is, going to be in the pipeline soon. But I imagine I will continue doing projects about black horsemen, because this is, this has been just a real honor to be connected with folks who have been preserving those stories. And I hope I get to keep working on that too.
Where are you going to do some press and some book signings and some readings and such?
Yeah, I will be at the Keeneland Library on May the 11th, and I hope folks come out not just to see me, but to see their new exhibit, which
yes.
I think is going to be really great. And I will also be on TV in Louisville and on the radio in Lexington and Louisville pretty shortly, I think. And I imagine that I'll be signing elsewhere. And the book is available, anywhere that you can Google on your phone, I think. it's very much, they're really trying to make it widely available.
Well, booksellers far and wide, and racetrack, invariably racetrack gift shops.
I hope so.
We'll have it, certainly here in Saratoga, Lyrical Ballad, and, the obvious, where all good equine story books are
yes.
sold, right?
I am hoping to be at the Saratoga Book Festival
Excellent.
In the fall. It's a great excuse to go to Saratoga. Not that I really need one, but Saratoga is one of my favorite places on the planet. So I'm hoping to get up there in the fall.
Well, and have you had contact with the Hall of Fame, with the museum?
No, not directly. I need to do that.
I'll take care of that.
Thank you.
My pleasure. I'll let I'll let your agent know, and they'll be delighted to have you come and do a signing during the meet.
Oh, I would. I mean, I can't. I know you. You know, you have a less idealized view of it, probably. But Saratoga to me is just like Saratoga and Keeneland are like the two places that I would be for my whole life if I could arrange
it. If you could alternate. You could alternate back and forth.
I could alternate. There that's what I would do.
Well, Catherine Mooney, having joined us. What about Twitter for you? Where do we find you?
Well, I'll be honest. I teach college kids, so I try to stay off social media.
Oh, there you go. That's fine.
If I don't, they show me things I don't want to see. So,
Yale University Press.
I am, yes, Yale University Press, and I am available on email. I'm delighted to hear from anybody who wants to talk about the book. And you can find all of my contact information on the Florida State University History Department faculty page.
Outstanding. Well, Catherine, I really appreciate it. I was looking forward. We've had back-to-back book conversations the last 2 days. Had Jennifer Kelly yesterday, and she was excited for you, and I'm sure you're excited for her.
I am very excited for her.
Yeah,
yes,
no, it's amazing that I say this every time we have a book conversation, and actually I've got several more that are going to be featured. It's amazing how many titles there are, given the supposed, narrowing of interest in racing.
Right.
And yet, there's, six, eight, 10 books a year being greenlighted about racing topics and personalities. So there's obviously, and there's a great appetite. I just know from the authors that come on the show how we've got an audience that, that absolutely feasts on the written word when it comes to the game. So, well done and continued success.
Well, thank you. And I have to say that as a longtime fan, when they told me I was going to be on, I was basically beside myself. So thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Catherine Mooney, and we'll see Catherine along the way. In fact, maybe even at the Keeneland Library. I think I'm still going to be in. Actually, that's the Thursday. I'll be in Nashville by then, but so I can't come by to meet, but at some point over
I'll
the summer.
I'll catch you later down the road.
Exactly, and I'll take care of the hall.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Catherine Mooney, everybody. Isaac Murphy, The Rise and Fall of a Black Jockey, an amazing story, and one that obviously Catherine motivated to flesh out beyond her first book. You might as well order both books right? There's no reason not
sure,
to.
Why not?
Exactly.
Sure, why not? Yeah.
Racehorse Men, How Slavery and Freedom Were Made at the Racetrack, and maybe as a companion piece, How Kentucky Became Southern.
Oh, great. Yes, for sure.
Right?
Yes, yeah. A great book.
Mary Jean Wall. Excellent. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Mooney and the Isaac Murphy story. Let's stay here because we got too much to do, and I'm and typically in trouble. And I didn't realize it because when I'm home operating here, the broadcast box is off to my right, and so I did not see that we had a signal issue. It's here. It's from the house because we've had trouble. In the house, too, all week. Very annoying. So if we missed a portion, we'll figure out what we missed, all right? And, I'm not 8 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes? Let me know, all right? So I guess if you missed the early... Had we started already with Kat? I don't even realize. 5 minutes, five, eight, okay. Ugh. All right. And we had already started with her? Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry I didn't catch it more quickly. We're gonna go down. Let's go down to Ocala. I promised Charlie. I got to get to him, and we will do a little bit of our Irish thoroughbred marketing conversations with the Breeze sale, the Breeze Up, as they call it, coming up in the end of May. And here we go. Charlie O'Neill, good morning.
How are you doing, Steve? Great to hear from you.
Nice to have you in the U.S.
Yeah, I just arrived in last night down in Ocala, just looking at the two-year-old sale, and we've a lot of Irish horses in the sale that were bought in Ireland, so you're coming over to see the guys who bought them, and hopefully they have good sales with them.
Explain what you try to do when you come over this way. And you know, Jeremy Green and I, you know, kind of talked about the role of ITM, the Irish Thoroughbred Marketing Team. But what's the promotion angle?
So I've been coming over here for, I'm 10 years in the job now, and I've started, you know, coming over here doing Saratoga, Keeneland, Breeders' Cup, so about 5 or 6 trips a year. And in that time, turf racing in America has just grown huge, you know, exponentially over that time. And it's to try and get more Irish bred horses over here in the racing system in America. So to try and get guys to come over to Ireland. So like when you look at the weekend we just had in Keeneland there with Twilight Gleaming winning, Love Rains winning, Muttering Games running a close second. You know, we have three great Irish bred winners, you know, or two great Irish bred winners and their Muttering Games second. So you're trying to get more people to, you know, get Irish bred horses over here to compete on the turf. And if they're buying good fillies, they'll go into the breeding system in here and hopefully produce future champions. Like today, we're hoping to see, the big hope today is American Rascal running in Keeneland, you know, the first son of Lady Aurelia, who was one of her big hope runs. I think it's American Rascal runs today.
Yeah.
And like that'll be, like if that runs well, I think that horse could be anything, and the vibes about the horse are superb. So, you know, bringing these good Irish fillies over here, running them, it makes economic sense then in the end as well.
Well, and you bring up American Rascal for Stone Street, going to go in the second today, the two-year-old maiden group, and Wesley, of course, handling, and already off to a fabulous start at the meet.
And Wesley has done really well with those Irish bred 2 year olds, you know, getting them in, getting them to Royal Ascot. And, you know, if this horse runs well today, will he take a bit of beating if he goes to go to Royal Ascot? I was actually out on the Stone Street farm this morning here in Ocala looking at the babies, you know, the pre training centre with Ian Brennan, and like to see so many beautiful horses, and, you know, like the American Rascal, it's just a dream for me to be able to do that.
How many imports of every age, Charlie, are there annually, and how has that number grown?
So yeah, the big growth for us being in the yearling market. So the yearlings every year we would have got about 6-7 years ago, you know, maybe 20-25 yearlings a year sold to America to raise over here. In the last 5-6 years, that has now gone up towards 60-70 now, and even 80 yearlings a year coming in here to race. And these are high-end yearlings, you know, bought at, you know, primarily I'm promoting the sales in Ireland, the Goffs Orby sale, and even our Tats Ireland sale. But they're being bought at other sales across Europe, in England and France. So they're all coming in here, and it's just, because turf racing is taking off, you know, people say, you know, there's not as many turf stallions here. So it's a great opportunity to buy proven turf horses in Europe and bring them over here. And they seem to do very, very well. The other market that's gone very, very well for the moment is the horses in training. So if horses run well at all in a maiden in Ireland, you win a maiden, or even finish second, third or fourth to an Aidan O'Brien horse, you've a valuable commodity. And a lot of those horses now are ending up in California. John Sadler has done really, really well with them. Phil D'Amato.
Yep.
A lot of those trainers have done very, very well with them. And it's become a very, very big market and a very valuable market to the Irish economy and the Irish breeding industry. that if you have nice horses from commercial trainers, there is a huge market here because turf racing is now seems to be so competitive and so good out here. And your prize money here is it's just superb. Like the whole structure of the turf racing system now in America is you know is as good as anywhere in the world.
One thing though that it, from that standpoint seems a little surprising. At the same time, it feels like the horses are still a value and that. You can get one at a square price, below a square price.
Well, that's another huge thing. So you come to the Orby in Ireland, where the average is €110,000, which is roughly maybe $120,000 now for the you know a good average horse. But they run in a maiden special here for $130,000.
Yeah.
So the prize money here is just it makes it so economic. It's you know it makes it very doable. You know, to buy in Europe now and bring over here these horses because the prize money here is just so great. And like we've seen that here on Denon Ocala at the 2-year-old sale. Like there's over, I think there's 12 Irish horses in the sale down here. Now, going back 4 or 5 years ago, if you had two, you would have been doing very, very well. But people like Kieran Dunn with his Wave Tree Stables, he had a beautiful No Name Never, I think, breezed early on in the week, which was the fastest time. The Gladwell's top line, you know, Luke and Bloodstock, Carl Keegan, even and then you go to Eddie Woods and Niall Brennan and Tom McCracken. They're all now believing in getting Irish horses over here to breeze, and they can make a profit on these horses because they're buying them at value, bring them over here, and they will win, you know, decent prize money in America.
Well, and it's funny because we had the conversation with Jeremy last week, and I had just talked to Mark Cassie, and I sort of hung up with Jeremy, and I realized, oh wait a minute, the Greens, John Green had come and bought Papilio, the Star Spangled Banner that had won the Appalachian, and I you know I keep this master list of all the stake winners. And every single week, Charlie, there's an Irish bred winning a stake here.
And another side of it, the Greens are very, very smart people, you know, DJ Stables and that, and they know all the benefits of buying in Ireland and that and bringing back here from tax efficiency point of view and everything. So they're buying really, really good horses, and it's making economic sense for them. And they're lovely people to work with. You know, I enjoy when they come over. John has been over a few times now, and Kim Valero sort of helps them buy horses, a very good agent. And it works. The Irish horses are working out here. I'm not saying they're all brilliant, but we are punching above our weight with the percentage of horses that we have out here. And it just makes my job that lot easier when I come over here.
Well, and just, you know, looking at recent, the last month or so, you mentioned D'Amato, Gold Phoenix winning the Grade 1 Kilroe.
Yeah.
There was Quatrell for Mullins. You know, another outfit that takes advantage of this. Jed Cohen was out ahead of the curve on this.
There's a lot of, and especially for the horse and training, those horses of older age, California really seems to be, has really taken them to heart now and done very, very well with them. Over here, they're looking more to 2-year-olds on the sort of the East Coast and that. But look, no matter where you go here, you go up to Woodbine in Canada, like it's a brilliant place for Irish horses, the tracks up there, because they're Tibetan tracks, I think. They're not sand-based, as much sand, so they can run on everything. But these horses, just look, the horses last. They're able to run for a 5, 6, 7, and 8-year-olds. They're in there month in, month out. They do the job, and it just makes my job so easy that when you come over here, people actually want to talk to you about coming to Ireland.
And what's not to like?
It makes a job. Yeah, but myself and Jeremy's job is, like, we don't sell horses. Our job is to attract people to come into Ireland and then make it as easy as possible for them to come to Ireland. But on an itinerary, if people want to come over and visit a few stud farms, go visit a few trainers, and all they have to do then, and we'll bring them to the sales, our job is to make people very, very comfortable in doing business in Ireland. What I try to do with young agents and young trainers is come in. We will look after your hotels and your transport and different things. You come in and learn. Just learn the pedigrees. And if you like it, come back and buy it. So we try to build longevity with our clients over here, and that they're happy to come and do business in Ireland and make it a fun trip for them.
Well, I was going to say, in terms of those tools and, you know, getting in contact, what lay out next steps for somebody that's listening and, you know, might feel a little intimidated because they don't, you know, they might not even have, Charlie, an agent, that's their own point person.
Yeah, so look, I would deal with these people all around the world. So I do people that would love to just come to Ireland and see the industry and get a feel for it. And, you know, in a one-to-one, we don't put them up. There's no force to do anything. It's to come and learn the industry. So it's easy. Contact me. My email is coneil@itm.ie. I'd be only too delighted to answer any queries. And, you know, or go to our website, www.itm.ie. All the details, my contact, my phone number is there, and I'd be only too delighted to help anyone that would love to come to Ireland and see this great industry that we have on both sides of the Atlantic.
Well, and of course, you're going to stay all next week for the sale?
I'm here only, unfortunately, I only stay till Tuesday because okay. It's the biggest racing week in Ireland, the National Hunt, is Punchestown. So just okay. The jump side yep. of it. It's our Cheltenham for Ireland and that. So I have to be home Tuesday morning early. I entertain maybe 100 clients every day at that from around the world that come in. So it's a busy 2 weeks for us, but I love Ocala. I love looking at babies, you know, two-year-olds and that. It's one of the highlights of my job. And going out on the farms here in the morning, seeing these, you know, young horses just having their first gallops.
Well, and of course, you mentioned Punchestown, and of course, basically, you know, follow-up, you know, to Cheltenham, and you got that handful of grade ones. Always a great week.
It's a brilliant week. It's close. My family have been involved in Punchestown for hundreds of years. I live close by the track. It's our... You know, it's the big one for us and for anyone that's from Kildare that just lives, eats, sleeps, drinks, Punchestown. And in my role now, it's even busier. And look, it's a great time to be involved in racing. And, you know, fingers crossed, the sales here will be good this week for those in Ocala or next week, especially for the Irish Red Horses. That'll make these people come back and reinvest. And every horse next week in Punchestown, you know, comes home safe.
Yeah,
that's all we can ask.
No, exactly. And speaking of, actually, Sean Clancy's going to be with us in this next half hour, a little while, and just this past weekend, Tom Garro for Leslie Young, Irish,
yeah.
Right? Irish bred that there's so many in our steeplechase community are tons
yeah,
of them.
And I had a guy, David Burns, who works for us actually in ITM, another member of the team. He was in Fair Hills last week. He was over in Maryland there meeting the National Hunt trainers and that. So, and getting them in for our store sales because. I say, and Sean does a great job. Like, he's National Hunt to the core and jump racing to the core. Great guy.
Charlie, this was terrific. A great follow-up to our visit with Jeremy. We'll keep having visitors, and I'll get I'll get Len and John Green to come on and talk, and maybe the Coens or, you know.
Well, it'd be even better, Steve, if we could get you to come to Ireland and do a show from Ireland.
It's a deal. Don't. All right. Can we come? I'd come for the Gorsebridge.
We're delighted. We'd love to have you over and do a show from Ireland and flat, and love to show you a bit of hospitality.
Oh well, okay.
We can put all this together off air.
It's a deal. All right. I'm an easy sell. Charlie.
Steve, thanks for everything, and we'll talk soon.
You got it. Charles O'Neill, everybody, and the Irish Thoroughbred Marketing Group that is ready and able and standing by to facilitate American buyers, whether it's, you know, young horses privately or whether it's in the public sales. And that Gorsebridge sale that's coming up at the end of May, it's 2 days. They do something a little different. In fact, next conversation, I want to hear about that because they do it slightly different. They have the breeze, you know, the breeze up, as they call it, the breeze show, and then they sell the next day. It's bang, bang. So... And the catalog, I know the catalog went online last week, in fact. I think the day before last week when Jeremy Green was with us. So that was productive. If I'm going to get a trip to... Maybe she will be. Maybe we can... I don't know, though. It's because I think the sale is the 25th. I think the Breeze Show is the 25th and the sale is the 26th. or the 26th and 27th. It's either Thursday, Friday, or Fridays and Friday, Saturday. It's in right in that range. In fact, here. So those of you that are looking at a calendar, you can. I put this up last week. There it is, Gorsebridge sale. And here we go. Upcoming sale. Boom. Oh, those are sport. Those are some of those sport horses. That's sales. Here we go. Upcoming. They got a three-year-old thing coming, May 3rd and 4th. But, All right. No, this is the sport. I landed in the sport horse division. And, no, we don't want sport horse. Sport horse, sport horse, sport horse. Come on. I put this up last week. Let me find it. I'll find it. We got to get Tony Black in as well as Sean Clancy. Then, if you thought the desk was a mess earlier, now it's a disaster. Jeff Franklin's going to join us in the second half as well, our Win with Thoroughgraph segment. Jackie Demerick. Well, we're going to go to Ocala twice today, it occurs to me. And she'll tell you about the farm workers fundraiser this weekend for those of you that are going to be in Ocala. And my point in asking Charlie about, you know, how long he was staying, because obviously those of you that are hearing about this for the first time, here's a perfect opportunity to introduce yourself and exchange cards, get a phone number, put it in the phone. Case, let's take the break here because it's the only chance we're going to get, and I'm a good 15 minutes behind, but we'll make up as much as we can. All right, don't even bother with music. Let's send it right out so we can get everything in today that we want to do. Thursday at the races. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help.